Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we're back with a special short COVID update for you with Dr. Joe Holly and my co-host, Sam Bradley. And we're going to go ahead and jump in with Joe here in just a second. But first, I got to bring up Sam, who, Sam, you still have more snow out in Colorado?
Well, there's tiny little piles left, but we had at least a foot. And it's just weird. It's almost like one day after another, the weather completely goes from almost summer to winter again. So we had that foot of snow and it all melted off. And today it's, I don't know, probably high 70s. So hopefully we'll stay in that pattern from this point on because I want to plant my garden. And I like snow in the winter, but I'm kind of over it. So there you go. So Dr. Joe, things warming up down there in Memphis?
Yeah, guys, it's been absolutely beautiful couple of days. We got more rain coming, but we've had a couple of nice days, and I've enjoyed actually seeing the sun shining.
Yeah, for real. And at least your grass will get green. Now, that's one thing I can say. We got a lot of green grass. So
I've heard I've still got grass, but I don't know that for certain.
That's the rumor, huh?
I want to hear, you know, what's going on with the patient presentation and some of the things that we can do to maybe save some lives that might otherwise succumb. So, Joe, do you want to jump in with what you've got for this week?
Well, sure, I'll be glad to. So, you know, I think part of what I wanted to talk a little bit about tonight is just to kind of recap the clinical presentation stuff and sort of what we have learned over the last few weeks of battling this very new and complex disease. So, you know, I think most everybody is quite familiar with the pulmonary presentation of this disease. Clearly, it attacks the lower respiratory system pretty aggressively with, you know, cough, fever, shortness of breath, hypoxemia, although not hypoxia in many cases. And a lot of what we have learned about that is to really treat the patient, not the numbers. It seems to have some effect on oxygen carrying capacity. It affects the hemoglobin molecule in some sort of way. You know, that's beginning to shape, I think, the way that we approach these patients. I've seen some quote unquote news reports, I'll use that word very loosely here, that have talked about, you know, that we're treating these patients wrong and that we shouldn't be using ventilators and all that kind of stuff. I think that that's just bad information, quite honestly. So part of what we've learned is that the disease, it does have features of ARDS, ARDS. It has features of high-altitude pulmonary edema, but that it is not either one of those illnesses, and that it's not that ventilators are the wrong thing to do. It's just that the way that you utilize the ventilator varies throughout the course of the disease process, and part of what we do earlier in the disease process is different than what we do with a ventilator later in the disease process when a more typical ARDS picture is present there. The other things that we've begun to notice that are quite interesting is that probably half the patients that are in the hospital have evidence of liver involvement. Liver enzymes are elevated in most of those patients. That may also affect their ability to generate clotting factors and all the many other things that the liver does. So liver involvement is not uncommon in these patients. Kidney damage is certainly common in severe cases. The evidence of the presence of kidney damage tends to portend a worse diagnosis, but it's not really known yet whether or not the virus itself is directly attacking the kidney or the effects of the virus elsewhere are causing kidney damage related to things like low blood pressure, hypotension, et cetera. One interesting thing is that it does appear clear that the virus can infect the lower gastrointestinal tract. the lower GI tract has angiotensin converting enzyme 2 receptors in it, which is where the virus seems to bind. So the lower intestinal tract has a lot of those receptors. And about 20% of patients that present now have gastrointestinal complaints, including diarrhea, et cetera. There's also some evidence that the virus may attack the neurological system directly, the brain in particular. We don't know exactly what's going on there, but we're certainly seeing evidence of encephalitis in some patients. And all the symptomatology that goes along with that, stroke, seizures, confusion, et cetera. The stroke-related components as well as the cardiac arrest-related components may be related to microvascular changes that are going on, microvascular clotting that's going on. And we'll talk some more about that in a few minutes because that's a very complex situation as well. It does appear that this loss of sense of taste and smell is surprisingly more common than originally anticipated, 20 or 25% of patients maybe. And it's unclear exactly what's going on there, but it's thought that the virus may actually be invading the nerve endings in the nose and damaging those cells. Although most folks tend to get that, those sensations tend to return. And then we continue to struggle, I think, with the microangiopathic damage that this virus appears to cause. Certainly, it is invading blood vessels, particularly, or the linings of blood vessels, particularly in capillaries and that sort of stuff, which also have lots of ACE2 binding receptors. And so that changes the way the endothelium interacts with the circulating blood, and that may be part of what's going on with increasing the chance of stroke, DVT, PE, cardiac arrest, and STEMI in some of these patients, as well as the direct effects on the myocardium as well. So it's pretty clear the more we learn about this disease, the more complex and broad its attacks seem to be. And that's, I think, part of the challenge of figuring out what to do with these patients and how to identify them, because they have such a wide variety of symptomatology.
Well, Joe, I would guess with the kidney and liver involvement that would play a big part in what they eventually find in the way of treatment, would it not, given that? I mean, it almost sounds like there's an array of different patient issues where you might be able to use one medication with one patient, but you can't use it with another because of the kidney and liver involvement. True?
I think there's probably some truth to that, Sam. There's a lot of work going on with several different agents, and I know there's been a lot of talk in the media related to the use of some of these drugs. There are some experiments going on with methylene blue, which is a drug that's been around for a very long time and utilized in the treatment of several fairly unusual disease processes, but in some ways, methylene blue is broken down into a parent compound of hydroxychloroquine, et cetera, and that may be part of the way that it may seem to work a little bit, and that it may have something to do with, again, affecting the way the virus can bind to this angiotensin-converting enzyme 2 receptor in the cells. So, I think targeted therapy is part of the solution here as we begin to better understand how these receptors work and what is actually happening at the cellular level so that we can figure out the right drug to maybe have some effect on that.
You know, Joe, it's interesting to hear like all of this multi-system impacts across the body's various systems. How does that impact presentation, especially for like in the field for EMS providers? They're not just seeing respiratory patients then. They're seeing patients with a multitude of complaints that may all be linked back to COVID.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Jamie. That's made it a very challenging disease to deal with in the field. I think that, you know, the safest approach right now is that we are utilizing our protective equipment for pretty much every patient. I know that seems like overkill, but I think the more that we see of this COVID-19 disease, the more that we appreciate it's a very varied presentation, and there is no sort of pathognomonic, you know, if they've got this, they've definitely got the disease. And that's been, I think, part of the real challenge and part of the reason that we've had a significant number of first responders in both EMS and emergency medicine, you know, being positive, because they are interacting with patients that they don't think at the time are likely to be COVID positive, but who turn out to be that way in the past, after the fact.
Wow. I've been hearing a lot of stuff watching TV, and are they doing trials with hydrochloroquine? I heard they had some scientists on that were talking about that, so I assume that.
Yeah, I don't know an awful lot about the details behind that. I know there are several trials with lots of drugs underway. You know, it's I don't know enough about sort of where they are in the process. I will throw a couple of insights out there. You know, it does appear that drugs like hydroxychloroquine, if it has much effect, may have more positive effects early in the disease. Those are sort of anecdotal studies based on experience so far, which is pretty limited. I know there's been an awful lot of push in the media and from political sources pushing the idea of the use of these drugs. I'll just remind everybody that there was a drug that was developed for the treatment of Ebola during the Ebola outbreak several years ago, which was later, which everybody at the time it was used felt very good about it and thought it had lots of potential, et cetera. And it was utilized in a trial in Africa during a later outbreak of Ebola, along with many other drugs. And the highly sought after, highly thought of drug was not even in the top 10 in its ability to have any impact on Ebola. So I would just remind everybody to be very cautious about what you hear in the media, and to realize that one or two stories of a good outcome don't really mean an awful lot. It's hard to separate a patient who got better, whether they were taking the drug or not, and assigning a cause and effect relationship to that.
And I think that's why it's important, Joe, for all of us in the medical side of things to really remind people to let the science do the science, and let's let the double-blind, peer-reviewed trials run their course. I know everybody's hungry for something to work right now, but this is with us for another year and a half, 2 years at least, and let's let these things run their course, because eventually we hope to have something that'll work, but we've got to wait and let the science talk.
I think you said that beautifully, Jamie. You know, there is a rush to jump on something that appears to be, promising early on, which later proves to be not promising at all or even harmful in some cases. So, you know, the first rule of medicine is do no harm, and that applies to situations like this particularly. So we don't want to be dosing people with medications that may ultimately be worse for them, just because there were a couple of anecdotal good cases early on.
Well, I think it goes back to your initial point, Joe, that these people can be in so many different statuses as far as their bodies and what's working and what's not working, that there doesn't seem, I don't see how it would be possible to have any kind of one size fits all unless it's prophylactic.
That's a good point, Sam. You know, I think we have to sort of tease out medications that are designed to treat a specific component of this illness, for example, the liver or the pulmonary or the GI component of this, versus drugs that are designed to reduce the possibility of transmission or reduce the replication of the virus, or in terms of, you know, a vaccine or antibodies, that sort of stuff, that, you know, the use of convalescent serum seems to have some benefit because, you know, folks have antibodies against the virus. And that, the you know, the few trials that have been done, there's only been, you know, less than 100 people, to my knowledge, that have received convalescent serum so far. And the results are mixed. You know, some cases have done well and others have not made any difference at all. And so it may be all about when you time that in the disease process and how much of it you need to give. And, you know, there's just an awful lot of things here that have to be figured out. So as you guys have very eloquently said, it just takes time, unfortunately, to get that done.
So I assume for those people that aren't sick enough to be in a hospital, and even the providers that may be ill, unfortunately, there's way too many of them, that regular OTC meds for diarrhea or any of the symptomology might still be okay?
Yeah, it certainly seems that way. You know, again, thankfully for the vast majority of folks who get this illness, they tend to do fairly well. You know, feel bad for a few days and recover and do all right. And thank goodness for that. But that, of course, still means that they are likely to be exposing those around them who may not have that same clinical course as them. And that's part of the reason that although they themselves may not get very ill, they may pass the virus on to someone who has a much worse outcome than that. So we definitely need to be careful here and continue to try to get this pandemic under control.
I agree, and I just really hope that people don't drop their guard too soon, which it sounds like a lot of people want to do, and I can totally understand that. But we don't need another resurgence of this anytime soon. As it's starting to get better, it might get worse.
Well, sure. You know, it's a little hard to say yet if it's getting better. Certainly the news the last few days has been very encouraging. I think that you know, in some cases, the spread may have slowed a little bit as we get away from high population density cities like New York City to places like Memphis. You know, we continue to grow in our numbers here at a pretty steady rate every day. I don't think we're anywhere close to our peak yet. I don't even know if we're going to you know, see a big surge, and by that, you know, a rapid increase in cases that exceed our capacity. I certainly hope that that's not the case, but, you know, we just don't know. It may start happening tomorrow, and it may not happen at all, and we'll keep our fingers crossed that it doesn't. We certainly have to stay vigilant and aggressive in testing and in PPE and in social distancing, and I understand the desire of folks to get back to work. I think we have to realize there's a trade-off between, you know, putting people back together in work or school or, you know, recreational environments, and that means increasing the transmission of the virus. The two are just, you know, opposite each other. Hopefully there's a balance in there somewhere that we can you know, begin to get folks back to work and not result in a tremendous surge that overwhelms our medical system, but one that is a bit more controlled and easier to manage.
Yeah, that's the big one right there. It just goes back to the old better safe than sorry. And Jamie, if need be, we can send you a few rolls of toilet paper.
I'm good. I have considered buying one of those giant, like, wheels of toilet paper that they use at the truck stops and just, you know, with, just have that, just roll it around the house where I need it. Anyway, Joe, thanks so much for making time in your busy schedule. I know you've got a lot going on and a lot to keep track of, so we appreciate all these updates that you've been able to put together for us, and we'll look forward to the next one. But in the meantime, be safe.
Thanks, guys. Y'all too. Everybody take good care of themselves out there, and please wear your PPE. You just never know who you're being exposed to.